And Skylar Baylor.
The first transgender male.
The first openly transgender athlete.
The first ever transgender person to play on an NCAA men's team.
Testosterone is one of like the only arguments about why trans women shouldn't compete in women's sports. Could you maybe present the key arguments why you disagree with them?
There is available research that supports that testosterone suppression does produce meaningful competition between cis and trans women. Michael Phelps produces half the levels of lactic acid. He's got twice the lung capacity of the average person. But when people talk about that, what do they say?
Wow.
If those differences exist in the women's category, it is immediately considered unfair.
If I were to decide tomorrow that I was a 47-year-old woman, should I be allowed to go shower in a women's locker room?
There's been no actual effect on sexual assault statistics across the states when this was kind of implemented.
It is playing on real fears that I think are valid. We do need to protect women and girls.
How optimistic are you, Skylar, and what do you think the next steps are now?
This is the Loaf Podcast. Welcome back to the bakery, everyone, where we break bread with the world's finest. Today, we're here with Skylar Baylor. He's the first trans D1 NCAA men's athlete swimming for Harvard until 2019. Ever since, he's been an advocate for trans and LGBTQ plus rights and has recently released his first book, He, She, They. Skylar, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. So a question that we ask all our guests is perhaps a bit of a strange one, but it's in line with our bread theme that we have here at the Loaf Podcast. And you'd be surprised how much you can find out about a person, and that's what your favorite bread is.
I love the question because I'm a big bread fan. My favorite kind of bread is sourdough, but it's a kind that's like, I like it to be chewy. It can't be, you know, like flaky or something. I want it to be chewy and like hearty, you know, like home style sourdough. So that's what I go with. But there's lots of other kinds of bread I like. That's the top of the list.
You say home style. Do you make it yourself or just
absolutely
home
not?
Style?
I cannot cook for my life.
No, neither. It's no. Bread is actually... Sorry, sourdough is the most common bread we get by far. So you're in good company.
Hey guys, I hope you're enjoying the episode. I just wanted to drop you in a word from our sponsor, Manscaped. You can use the discount code LOAF to get your discount because even a lion needs to tame its mane.
Get the Performance Package 5.0 Ultra from Manscaped now. Stay fresh with no cuts so that your baguette leaves no crumbs.
I see also on your Instagram... Of course, we said you were competing in swimming for Harvard, but you've started running recently. We just had Eliud Kipchoge on. I don't know if you know who he is.
Yes.
He's a marathoner. Have you been finding running? How's it different?
Well, there's a lot more land involved. Running is hard. It's a whole lot harder, in my opinion, than swimming. I also swam my whole life. So I learned how to swim when I was like 10 months old and I competed from a really young age and I never ran. So, running has been incredibly difficult for me and like painful and so much physical therapy has been necessary to like have my feet learn how to run, honestly, like take the impact because I spent so much of my athletic career in water. But I'm loving it, which is strange to say. It's taken a while to love it, but I've been really, I mean, I think the primary thing that I love about it that's different from swimming is there's a freedom to it. With swimming, I love the water, but most of my hours in the pool are in the pool and going back and forth and staring at this black line. And that's great. And I loved it, but I love going to run and seeing the city and like exploring new places. And I travel a lot for the work that I do. And so I get to see lots of new cities and I think it's been really awesome. So yeah, I've been enjoying it. Mm.
What kind of training did you do? Like, because you mentioned like strength training and stuff. Did you do any like cross cardio training when you were swimming or was it just straight up in terms of cardio just in the pool?
I mean, swimming is a very aerobic exercise, so we didn't need extra cardio. There was times where we did like some VO2 max based stuff that was cycling. So we would do spinning, you know? Mm-hmm. So I've done that, but none of my teams that I ever was on made us run, which is fairly common. I think that we don't run as swimmers just because the impact can be harmful for, if you're not used to it, you know what I mean? Like you don't train doing impact sports. You shouldn't randomly suddenly do like 10 miles running or something.
Yeah, I know what you mean about the impact. I ran 5K yesterday and I'm just really not a runner. And my knees, you know, my knees just really feel it. And it's really, for me, it's kind of like an uncomfortable thing to do. I just much prefer weights, I would say.
Sure, that makes sense.
Yeah. But to kind of get into it a little bit, for our listeners, Skylar, could you maybe tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. Well, as you all have said, my name is Skylar. I use he, him pronouns. I'm the first openly D1 men's trans athlete in the NCAA. And if anybody, I don't know how many of your listeners are in the US or in the UK, but the NCAA is the largest governing body for college sports. D1 is the highest level. And so much of my platform these days has been built off of that initial foray into being a public figure. When I started in college in 2015, I didn't know really any other trans athletes. And so I decided to talk about my experience and gave hundreds of media interview pieces. I gave 102 speeches before I graduated from college. And I sort of built this platform, I guess, from the platform that I was given as a transgender educator and advocate, and then now author. So I've worked for the past 10 years or so on what I would consider gender and trans liberation more generally, not just about sports. Though sports are a guiding light in many ways, and also the original light. Yeah, I host a bunch of workshops, support groups for trans and queer folks. I do life coaching sessions for mostly trans and queer folks and their parents. I do a bunch of consulting as well. And my primary work is doing public speaking, trainings, workshops for companies, businesses, and schools, again, to advance gender and trans liberation.
You said you did like, was it 102 speeches whilst you were at Harvard before you even graduated? So. Yep. Obviously, you would have developed a long time, like a lot as a communicator over that time. How has your approach changed? And kind of what are you open with now? And what have you learned through just doing it so much?
Yeah, that's a great question. Many people are surprised to hear this, but my approach, especially at the beginning part, has not actually changed really at all. I give a very similar speech, at least the first 15 minutes, now than I did at the beginning. I've thrown in some new speeches. Like I've worked for, you know, sometimes I do a new speech, but mostly I'm giving a very similar speech to the first year of speeches. And the reason is that telling a story, I think, is the best way for people to get involved in, a fight or a conversation or a concept that they're not familiar with, is to say, this is a person. And so I always start with telling a bit about my story. And I actually start, the first picture I put up on the board is a picture of me when I was 10 months old. So me as a baby, because I feel like everybody can immediately relate to a baby to some extent. Right. And they're not going to be like, we hate that child or we hate trans people because they're looking at this baby. They're just looking at a cute baby. You know what I mean? So a lot of it hasn't changed. What has changed over the years is that when I started this work, most people had not even heard of the word transgender, or if they had, there was like no really strong idea of what being trans meant. They were kind of like, is it changing something, gender? I don't know. Like there was like a lot of missing, just not understanding, ignorance, right, about trans people. Now, transgender is a word that lots of people know. Do they know it correctly? Not so much, but a lot of people think they know a lot about trans people. We're a huge topic in the media, which I'm sure both of you know, and I'm sure we're going to talk about. But this has created a massive amount of disinformation, propaganda, lies, like straight up just not facts at all, that people are armed with before I even step into the room. And so the work, I said, that's why I said the beginning hasn't changed, but what comes after has shifted, because I've had to figure out how to have people unlearn the things that are false about us first, before I can then teach them what is correct about us and about gender liberation more expansively.
Yeah, that must be really tough, because the way I see it, at least, is that it's like two sides of a coin. In one sense, it's better that there's more discussion around it, but on the other side, it's like people are getting like, I don't know, in some way it's becoming such a contested topic that people are getting almost more heated about it. So it's like two sides. But that kind of leads into my question, which is kind of, nowadays, what do you find to be the biggest challenges around being an advocate in 2024?
I think the biggest challenge is what I just named, which is that there's so much misinformation out there, and just so much information, right? We are in a society where there is an overflow and just complete ease of access to a massive amount of information. And when I say information, I'm not using it scientifically in that it's correct, right? I mean, information is anything we can find, whether that be on TikTok, on Instagram, on BuzzFeed, Pinterest, I don't know, wherever people are finding the news. And even the news, which is supposed to be, you know, by journalists who know what they're talking about, frequently publish incorrect things about trans people. Or there was a recent statistic that was like some, I think it was like 30-something percent, or maybe even higher, of New York Times articles that have talked about trans people do not quote a single trans person. So people are also talking about these issues and about us as trans people, but not talking to us, right? So we have, again, a massive amount of overload of information. And then most people, in my understanding or opinion, are not actually armed or equipped to accurately, adequately digest that information, to filter it, to critically examine what is real, what is fake, what needs more evidence, what is a, you know, a bold claim but isn't actually proven. And in this overloaded information world, I think what's difficult with trans people is the loudest voices are not the ones that are necessarily right, but they're the ones with the most power, which really means the ones with the most money. And when we break that down, the voices that we're listening to, which means the information we're digesting that's the loudest, is often not right, right? Not only morally speaking, but I'm talking about factually. Like, there has been many people that were yelling about trans athletes, for example, claiming that, let's just use the most, you know, talked about issue, for example, that Leah Thomas like beat all of her competitors in all of her events and dominated all these records. Leah didn't break a single national record. She didn't break an Olympic record. She didn't even compete in the Olympics, right? But all of these completely false, easily provable things were being stated about her and her performance that are just wrong. But so many people believe them. Like, I can't tell you how many people who tell me that they are allies have come up to me and said, but didn't Leah blank? And I'll be like, no, here's the clear proof. Here is the literal stopwatch, right, from that meet. So yeah, that's the hardest part, is the amount of rampant information that is often not based in truth, research, or science that people are starting with, as opposed to starting with like a blank slate.
Mm. I think Leah is one of the clearest examples of the loudest voices aren't necessarily the right ones or even the factual ones. Like, for example, in the book, how you mentioned saying something like she was 426th competing against men and then first. And one of the things that loud voices do as like an act of violence against trans people is purposeful misgendering. And that leads me to, I just wanted to ask you a question, which I think you may not have even spoken about in specifics before, is in Korean, there's no gendered pronouns. Is that right?
Yeah, correct.
And I've thought about that as part of gender liberation. Like, if we just got rid of gender pronouns, that might reduce the importance. And I was wondering, like, has that, do you notice like an effect in the difference on culture at all from having that removal?
That's a really good question. And I think there's a couple different ways we could answer it. The first is that, while I'll just use your example of Korean, while Korean does not have gendered pronouns, many other words are gendered. And this is similar with, I think, many other languages that don't have gendered pronouns. They have other gendered epithets. And so, for example, the family relationships are really important in a lot of East Asian cultures. And you can see that reflected in the words, but their family relationships dependent on gender. So if I write now, for example, the word that I would use to refer to my brother would be different based on age, as well as like age in line, who's older, as well as gender. So right now, like, he would call me Hyung, which is a younger boy to an older brother. So he calls, that's Hyung. But I call him Dongsaeng, which is an older brother to a younger brother. And with sister, he is beforehand, right before I transitioned, he would call me Nuna, which is younger boy to older sister. But if he had been a girl, he would have called me Unni. So there's lots of other ways that culture gets wrapped into language. I think, for example, in Korean, I think that sort of the reflection of relationship being gendered and aged is reflective of cultural values, right? And so gender is still there, just not in pronouns. The reason I'm saying this is because I think that many cultures have solidified importances of different relationships between people, be it gender or age or status, what have you, that is reflected in language. And sometimes that has included not gendering, right? There's a famous fact within the community of how, like I believe it's Yoruba, there was no word for woman before colonization. And a lot of structure in that society was not structured around gender, but rather about hierarchical age. And so age was the most important distinguishing factor. And so there wasn't even a word for woman, because that wasn't a distinguishing sort of detail, right? So would the world, English speaking world be better if we removed, gendered pronouns from English and everybody was they, them, for example? Perhaps, but we would have to have that reflected in our cultural values, right? We would have to have gender not be the most important thing that we think about when we think about others. But right now, most people, the first thing they do when they meet somebody or see somebody even walking down the street is they gender them. They might not even notice that they're doing that. But the first thing is, oh, who'd you see down the street? Oh, a man who blank, a woman who blank. And if we can't figure out their gender, that's the first thing we notice, right? So we have been socialized to believe and to experience the world with gender as one of the most, if not the most important characteristics about somebody. And until we can remove that, I don't think it will matter how much we degender, pronouns, for example, because it's something we've attached so much value to in society. I don't know if that makes sense or answers your question.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I think one of the misconceptions with it is kind of that is what causes it to stick is kind of the naturalization that kind of, this is how it is. There's just men and there's just women. And that's kind of the natural way it's been. And then kind of queerness has kind of been a recent thing what has jumped out. But like you say, for example, in Yoruba, there wasn't the word for women. In indigenous cultures, there's also, I can't remember the exact term. So is it two-spirit?
Some people use the word two-spirit. That was a term that actually came out of a desire to create sort of like pan-Indian, pan-Native American, what's the right word? Sort of like collective community. And I believe it was the 1960s or 1970s. I wrote it in the book, of course. Don't remember the actual date. But so two-spirit is not a word that exists in any specific Native language, but because they were trying to create sort of a general community, they used the word two-spirit to be accepting or inclusive of many different indigenous terms that a lot of them have been lost due to, again, effects of colonization. And then some of them that, we can name a few here and there. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, but yeah, like I say, kind of one of the misconceptions is that queerness and gender and different conceptions of gender have kind of jumped out of nowhere. What are some of the other biggest misconceptions that you come across that are kind of the easiest ones to just deal with straight away and just...
I mean, that's a great one. I'm glad you named it because so many people think that, trans people are infecting the world with transness and everybody's becoming trans. But the reality is that we've always been here. We just haven't always been talked about in this same way. A lot of the strict ways we see gender now are a result of different systems of oppression saying this is how we have to be. And these are the small boxes we need to fit in. Other misconceptions. A lot of people think being trans is a choice. And I don't know anybody who's chosen to be trans. I know that we choose to come out. We choose to share identities. We might choose to transition, undergo gender affirmation processes, but nobody is choosing their gender identity the same way that people who are not trans don't choose theirs. You don't choose not to be trans. You don't choose to be trans. So that's a big one. I think with the sports conversation that we've touched on and perhaps are going to come back to, I think a big misconception is that trans people, particularly trans women, are either a threat to sports or a threat to women's sports, and are really just people who are trying to win sports by transition. And the reality is that trans people don't transition to play sports. People transition to live, right? To be themselves and also happen sometimes to be athletes. In terms of the threatening women's sports, there's so much we could go by there. And if you want, we can really break that down. But I think that the shortest answer is there's actually no evidence that supports this argument that trans women have ever dominated or currently dominate women's sports. We've had inclusive policies in the NCAA where I competed, as well as in the Olympics and beyond, that have included trans women for a long time now. And we haven't seen this, massive rise of trans women competing in women's sports. In fact, most people cannot name a single trans woman who have ever won a national or international competition, even though they think of Leah Thomas. Most people can't name her. And I'm like, if trans women have been dominating women's sports, don't you think you'd be able to name a few? and most people can't. Or if they can name Leah, great, they can name one, right? So I think, you know, again, there's much more we could talk about there, but that's a short answer on that front.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think we'll get back to sports in a sec, because it's one of the most highly contested topics. Absolutely. But I just to come back just briefly to the fact that we're speaking about language, and the fact that people say that, oh, being transgender is like it's a new thing. But yeah, I do English here at Oxford, and I study Shakespeare, and even discussions about like ambiguous gender were so prevalent even back then in the 16th century. And I wrote a paper on it. And I just think that there are so many misconceptions around it. But coming to your advocacy and to real life scenarios, how do you perhaps more pertinently deal with people who are bigoted? How do you kind of approach that?
Yeah.
Whether they want to be bigoted or not?
It depends on the situation. And I know that might sound like a annoying answer, but if I'm in a situation where I'm educating people, so I'm doing a podcast interview, I am teaching a class, I am giving a workshop, I'm giving a speech and answering questions, right? If I'm in the place where I have consented to, and often when I'm doing work, I'm being paid to, right? I have decided I'm going to do this education work, then my approach is often very measured. I am very careful to consider what might be coming up for that person that could help me have a better conversation with them. I'm often trying really hard to actually find the strengths in their arguments so that I can hear what they intend to say and then see if we can find common ground. And I found that to be a more productive method of communicating. What I mean is that if they say, you know, I really want to protect women's sports and therefore I want to exclude trans people, then I'll say, hey, I really agree with you. We should protect women's sports. And here are some other, you know, details about how we go about that. Maybe your way is not the way we protect women's sports, but I try to find common ground. And I found that there's actually quite a bit of overlap we can have with most people. If their intent is to be bigoted, we'll get to that in a second. But if their intent to have is a conversation, then there's a lot of overlap we can have. And so that's what I'll try to do. Now, if I'm in a situation that's not an education specific moment and I haven't actively consented to this conversation, I might educate or have a conversation, but I might also say, hey, I don't actually want to have this conversation. I'm not just here to educate you because you want to have this conversation, or I don't feel comfortable having this conversation because what you have said is very bigoted, right? There's many different ways I can set a boundary. And I think especially when I feel that the person who is engaging with me is only engaging to share their opinion and not also to hear mine, then I'm usually apt to set a boundary and say, listen, I will not have this conversation if we're not actually going to talk, and your only goal is to refute everything that I say.
Yeah. Can you usually tell when someone's like purposefully being bigoted? Like, is that easy to tell?
I would say online, yes, because a lot of trolls comment the same thing repeatedly. So I mean, that's an easy rule. I don't engage with most hateful comments online. It's just not worth my time.
Sure.
In person, what I'm looking out for is, are they actually integrating what I'm saying in their responses? Because you and I could have a conversation for an hour and you could disagree with everything that I say, but you can, in how you communicate with me, you could indicate that you're at least integrating what I'm saying. You're hearing what I'm saying and you're thinking about it, and then you're presenting a disagreement. That to me is sustainable, because you're hearing me, I'm hearing you, we're talking about it. You might disagree and I can't force you to agree with me, but we can talk. If everything I say is clearly not getting digested, it's just no, and then your opinion, to me that indicates that we're not actually having a conversation. You're just saying what you want to say. I will sometimes make space for that if I think there's an end point. Like if I'm like, okay, I'm just going to listen for 20 minutes and see what happens. Sometimes that's actually really productive if I have the energy for it, because what happens is that person just needs to get out what they have to say. They feel like they've been not heard, and then they're actually willing to listen. But it's really for that one dependent on, do I have the energy to listen to what might be and what is likely to be a lot of transphobia before I then can have this conversation? Or do I say, you know what, I'm not going to weather and tolerate this right now?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Now, obviously you're like, how would I put it? So you're someone who has experience in talking about these kind of things, and you have experience in dealing with people who might have arguments or criticisms or difficult questions. So you're kind of more used to dealing with it. What would maybe your advice be to our queer listeners who are not so experienced with dealing with those difficult questions?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's something that I get asked a lot, because I think one of the reasons I feel I can have these conversations is due to the practice and the confidence that I have, and knowing, you know, I've done this, you know, 100 times. So I know at this point, check out, right? I know at this point, push in. Mm-hmm. I think that we always have to assess our capacities to have these conversations. And that does mean disengaging and stepping out when we don't feel we can confidently have the conversation. And I think that a lot of people will push past a boundary. They'll be like, no, I have to do this. I have to make a difference. I have to make this person understand. And if we do that and we're not ready for it, we can actually cause more harm, because we say things we don't mean. We upset ourselves. We upset the other person. We just increase. It's like having a fight when you're not, or an argument when you're not ready for it, right? I think there's, you know, common discourse where, like, if you're too angry, you take a break, right? And I think that's kind of reflected here, in my opinion, of like, you need to be, I encourage people to assess their own energy, time, desire to engage in these conversations before they do, because that can really help the productivity of the moment. The other thing is I always encourage people to express feelings as much as they can, as opposed to just facts. And what I mean by that is not, you know, screaming your feelings, I'm so angry, but I mean saying, like, this conversation is really hard for me, and what you said to me really hurt my feelings. It upset me. And I really want to have this discussion with you, but I'm really struggling to stay level minded because what you said to me is mean, and it didn't feel good. So I'm wondering if we could, you know, take a break before we come back, or, you know, whatever the desire is. But I often recommend something like that, because I think it can help people take a step back in a moment where they do know what to say, but they can't get it out the right way, because they're, you know, overcome with emotions, which is totally normal.
Mm. I think that kind of links to your point about the connection thing, because that's kind of like offering up almost your vulnerability. I don't know what you think about this, sure. But it's kind of offering up your vulnerability on your side, so that then you're suddenly not, you know, two interlocutors having a discussion with propositions on either side, but you're two humans. Yeah. And then that allows you to like really see their point of view.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's a huge centerpiece of it is, can you connect as two people really having a conversation about something that, yes, is bound to have disagreements, but that at the core is two people conversing. Anything you can do to help that, I think is usually productive. And if you don't want to do that because that vulnerability is too painful or too risky, I also think that is completely valid.
Mm-hmm. So I think now is probably a good time to move on to the sports discussion, which we've been leading up to, just because it's hard not to mention it when you're discussing this. But I love the way you did it in the book, where it's kind of, you present the claim, and then you kind of break it down. So for example, you said like, testosterone is one of like the only semi-thoughtful arguments about why trans women shouldn't compete in women's sports. So in that interest, for our listeners who haven't read the book, could you maybe present some of like the key arguments that are made, and then why you disagree with them?
Sure. Yeah. Well, we'll start with the one you named. So the only truly semi-thoughtful and semi-emphasis on semi-thoughtful argument that a lot of people fall back on when they say trans women shouldn't be included is about testosterone levels. They'll say, well, there's higher levels of testosterone that will usually, they use incorrect language. Let's say that men have over women. I like to always start with reminding people, when we're talking about trans women in sports, we're still not talking about men. If you want to talk about biological differences, great. I'm not ignoring those. We can. We just need to be specific, right? So we can say higher levels of testosterone in women. We can say those assigned male at birth. We can say those with testes, or those who have experienced testosterone-driven puberty. But we need to be specific, not only because that reduces transphobia, but it's also more accurate, right? If we just said men, what are we talking about, right? So as again, also transphobic. So the first thing is that language. The second thing is, when we think about testosterone at all elite levels that include trans women in the women's category, you actually have to reduce your testosterone levels in order to compete in the women's category. And you can't just do it one day and then show up the next day. They all have a time a requirement. The lowest one that I've seen is 1 year. The highest is 3 years. So 3 years on testosterone suppressions, proving that your testosterone levels have been lowered. So this is really important to recognize, because a lot of the disinformation, the lies about trans women in sports, are based something along the lines of, well, they can just say they're a woman and be on the women's team. No, they can't. In all elite levels, again, of women's sports that allow trans women to compete in the women's category, there is a requirement of reducing your testosterone levels for at least 1 year and up to 3 years, and proving that with your labs submitted, as well as something that says you're trans and like a doctor's note basically certifying you as who you are. So there's a lot of requirements, not to mention that even getting access to that hormone suppression and gender affirming care, that's what we call it, gender affirming hormones, even just getting access to that is difficult. So the concept that somebody could just show up at the doctor's office and be like, give me the hormones, that also is very difficult in the United States. And in the UK, there has been lots of legislation trying to stop people from accessing gender affirming care as well. So all of this is to highlight that it is not easy to show up as a trans woman and want and show that you want to play in the women's category. So that's the first thing. The testosterone levels, it's a pretty bogus argument to say the T levels are higher, therefore they can't play. The second part of that argument, though, is this concept of a legacy effect. And what they talk about with legacy effects is, okay, yes, we've reduced the testosterone levels currently, but there has been a history of elevated testosterone levels. And that has a quote legacy, right? A leftover effect on one's body. And there's been some research on that, not a lot, and mostly not on trans women, because I think a lot of the research has been focused on cisgender people. But there is available research that supports that testosterone suppression does produce meaningful competition between cis and trans women. And there's a recent study that reviewed 11 years, I believe it was, 11 years of research on trans women in elite level sports. And they found, and I quote, there is no significant advantage that trans women have over cisgender women when they have undergone testosterone suppression. So the research that is available clearly states there is no, there's no evidence for this, this advantage that people claim that trans women have because of testosterone legacy effects. But I also want to add, let's just say there is, let's just say we have the research. I've clearly stated that exists, right? We've clearly found no significant biological advantage, but let's pretend that there is some legacy effect of testosterone just for a second. That would then mean that there's some group of women who have some level of testosterone effects that have continued past whatever point they have had suppression. And therefore, maybe there is a difference in their body that is a result of testosterone. And I'm saying maybe because of the next thing I'm about to say, we actually don't know that testosterone is the primary driving factor in every single sport of people's benefits, right? Of being better at one sport or the other. So the thing that I think I want to offer is that even if there is some difference, how do we know A, that it's definitely an advantage in their sport? And B, why is that the only thing that we're focused on? Why about there's so many other different advantages that people have in sports that cause them to be better or worse at a sport, but we are so focused on the legacy effects of testosterone for trans women, right? And the reality there, I'll just give you a really easy example. And Ollie, you mentioned my book. So this is in the book for those who haven't read it. Michael Phelps, you all have heard of him. If you haven't, you've truly been living under a rock, right? Winningest Olympian of all time. Michael Phelps produces half the levels of lactic acid than the average athlete. Half the levels of lactic acid. That's crazy, right? That's lactic acid, for anybody who doesn't know, that's the substance that builds up in your muscles and makes them burn and makes you say, ouch, I have to stop. And he produces half the levels of the average athlete. Not the average person, average athlete. The other side, he's got twice the lung capacity of the average person. Twice the lung capacity in a sport where you hold your breath. Is that a benefit? I feel like unequivocally, yes, right? He's got plenty of other things. We'll name those two as the main biological advantages. There's no contesting these. You can literally Google Michael Phelps biological advantage and see whole reports people have done on his body. But when people talk about that, what do they say? Wow, amazing. Michael Phelps is a genetic freak. Incredible. That's amazing. And they praise him. Same thing with LeBron James or Shaquille O'Neal or anybody else in the men's category. If they're a foot taller than everybody else, that's incredible. But if those differences exist in the women's category, it is immediately considered unfair. And I think we need to consider why, right? Why are the differences between examining the men's category versus the women's category, and which women in the women's category are the ones that are consistently being called out because they are largely already marginalized women, Black and brown women, trans women, and intersex women. And we have to start thinking about this more expansively. This is not just about protecting women's sports and then therefore excluding trans women because of some perceived biological difference. This is about trying to maintain a very specific view of who is acceptable in women's sports. And it's not black women, and it's not brown women, and it's not trans women, it's not intersex women. Again, it's a very specific view. So I could go on forever, but I feel like I should pause there.
Yeah. In sports, of course, the discussion is focused around a lot. And already people don't even know that this has to happen, but the discussion is focused a lot around medical transition. So whether that be, it's primarily obviously hormone-based, but of course, I think this is one of the biggest misconceptions, even for people who see themselves as trans positive or as an ally, is that kind of medical transition is kind of what creates transness. And I was wondering whether you could unpack a little bit the relationship between those two and how it's actually not so simple.
Sure. Yeah, I think a lot of people use medical status, if you will, in many different arenas, but particularly in trans identity, as what is validating of transness, right? Oh, have you transitioned, right? Or have you gotten the full transition? And this ranges from any access to transition to only, you're only really trans if you've gotten surgery, basically. And these stereotypes, I think, are largely based in the reduction of gender to body, gender to biology, and people to their body parts. And it's not that these aren't important. You know, for a lot of trans people, gender affirmation and changing bits of our presentations of our bodies is important, right? And sometimes for some people, life-saving. And it's not the only thing that we are. And I think for me, I'll just speak from my own perspective. Before I transitioned, so before I got top surgery, before I started testosterone, I was still trans. Maybe some people didn't perceive me that way, but I have always been me. And I didn't come up one day and be like, ah, today I'm becoming trans. Like, it's not a becoming, it's an is. And the becoming is how much I present or how much I affirm or what I show to others. Confidence that I, you know, gathered and so on. But I've always been trans and I've always been me. I just have learned how to express that and I've learned how to affirm that. And that's where the medical aspects can come in. But there are some trans people that don't transition, that don't ever shift anything about themselves. And that's perfectly okay.
You mentioned as well, not to keep saying you mentioned in the book, but just because there's so much interesting stuff to unpack. How a lot of people close to you, even with often good intentions, could react quite badly, for example, if you were to say they were transphobic or to call them out on a specific behavior, over-apologizing, whatever it be. What's your advice then to people who may have a trans friend, a trans family member, or are just trying to be allies to the people around them in like integrating that feedback better and just in general, like being better allies?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think, you know, a lot of people have a really good intention to try to support, but then when they are told that they failed in some way, react really poorly. And I think it's a lot because nobody likes to be told that they've failed, and people take it personally. I'm generalizing. Maybe not everybody does this, but you know, I feel like most people, when told you did this wrong, are like, ah, no, I didn't. Or, you know, I'm so sorry. And it becomes this whole thing and they make it about themselves. And I'm guilty of this too. I'm not trying to put myself above this at all. It's been a big learning process for me in like my relationship, for example, with my wife, or like interpersonal relationships with other friends. And then also doing the work that I do in teaching allyship, to have, you know, have the understanding, again, in myself and in others, that we don't always get it right. And actually, we should expect sometimes that we're going to get it wrong. And when we do, how we respond is usually more important than whether or not we got it right in the first place. And that takes an amount of internal resilience. It takes saying, hey, I'm going to mess up. And when I do, I'm not a horrible person. I didn't do this terrible, terrible thing. This isn't a descriptor of my character. It's just, I need to address this moment now. Right. And Ollie, you know, you probably read this in the book, but I've made mistakes and I've been called racist and I've made racist errors. And that was really hard for me to initially digest, especially this one I did very publicly, which I mentioned in the book. And if you're curious, you can read that chapter. But I stumbled a lot in when I was called racist, and I said, no, I'm not. And I tried to defend myself and I tried to explain myself and I dug myself a very deep hole. And what was really important for me was being able to recognize, you know what? I did do this thing that hurt some people, and it doesn't matter what I think about it. And yes, I actually also ended up agreeing with them ultimately and learning so that I could agree. But even it didn't matter if I agreed. My what I failed at most was when somebody said this hurt, I said, no, it didn't. And that's not okay. And I think when I think about allyship, the truest intention in allyship is, can you show up when somebody says, ouch, and say, oops, and fix it, as opposed to saying, I didn't mean that, because our intentions don't always land. And that, again, is a human happening, and we have to address it in the moment, as opposed to trying to explain it away.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point. And I think I really agree with what you say about kind of learning from that, because I feel, just from my own experience, in the last 3 years, especially, I've really learned a lot about queer experiences, especially. And I think that it is really about learning and wanting to learn. And that's not to say that maybe I haven't, for example, made mistakes in these ways, but it's about, and it's not about taking away responsibility or making those mistakes okay, but it's kind of about learning from them and really actively trying. And, you know, I think for some people, it's been so kind of conditioned in them from a really young age, from the parents, for example, that, you know, this is the way it is, that it's almost for younger people, at least to some extent, not their fault. I was wondering what you think about that. For example, people who have had very conservative parents, for example, who have been taught a certain thing at a young age, how do you kind of approach them to show them the right way when they might be so fixed in their views? That's kind of how I mean it.
Yeah. I like that question. A lot of what I do as an educator, and I want to be specific because there's, again, ways I approach things when I'm in educator mode versus what I would do in like my personal life. When I'm in an education mode, a lot of what I do with people who seem stuck or sort of maybe very rigidly attached to what they believed growing up is ask questions. Where did that come from? Where did you learn that? Why do you think you learned that? Are you sure that that's the truth? If so, how? And I'm asking these questions when I have these conversations with as much genuine curiosity as possible. Like, I really try to sit there and think, how do we get here? And it's not a, oh my God, how do we get here? Like, it's not a judgmental question. It's truly like, what did you learn that brought you to this place? And maybe there's something for me to learn, right? And sometimes I do learn in these moments a lot about, like, for example, religious beliefs that I didn't understand or didn't know more about. And it's been actually really helpful to hear people explain how they came to their conclusions. Sometimes as that happens, there are little pieces where I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. I know X, Y, and Z about that. Can I share it with you too? And that then can expand a little bit more. It's like, I imagine sometimes that people have walked this very specific path and I'm like, oh, there's all these other doors you missed on that path. Like, can we talk about them? But what I'm doing is saying, hey, did you consider this other thing? I'm not saying you're wrong. And there's a really important distinction between trying to have a conversation with somebody and telling them that they're wrong versus trying to have a conversation with the intent to show them things they might not have previously considered. And so that's the difference. I'm not trying to say, you're really stuck in conservative beliefs and therefore you're wrong. I'm trying to say, what are these beliefs and how did you get there? And are there any things that maybe you missed along the way? So that's my approach. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I do find that the sort of, like, I don't know, maybe Socratic method, if you will, of asking questions is often more productive and yields more connectedness and therefore more allyship than you're wrong and I'm right kind of
approach. And just a quick question, since you mentioned religion. And it might be a bit of a touchy subject, but how do you respond if someone says, oh yeah, I'm a Christian and God made two genders?
Yeah.
How do you respond there?
That one's always a interesting one to have a conversation about. And I will start by saying that none of my intentions and hopefully none of my actions in those moments with folks that will then harness religion as a way to dismiss my existence or more. None of my intentions is to disregard what they say. And I mean that let me be more specific. I've had conversations with people that are like you said, but God said there's two genders. I'm not going to sit there and try to tell them what God did or didn't say, because I don't know. I can't, I'm not going to, you know, not going to tell them that. I'm not, you know, a theologist or theologian by any means. I have been raised in Christianity. And so there's some things I know about the Bible. And so I might share certain pieces that I know. I really like, I mean, sometimes it depends on the moment, and the person, and what kind of like conversation they're open to. The simplest is saying, a lot of times when people will say that, like, oh, you need Jesus, you need God, whatever. And they'll say a bunch of things about how I'm messed up because, you know, I'm defying what God gave me. And I'll actually ask them a lot about what Jesus was like. And we, you know, Jesus was somebody who, there's a lot of evidence about this too, and it's in the Bible. So I'm focusing on the religious texts. Jesus was somebody who stood up for a lot of the marginalized people of his time. In fact, pretty much all of them, all of the outcasts, the social outcasts, the religious outcasts, the people who didn't follow the rules, he was somebody who stood up for those people. And so when we talk about being Jesus-like, a lot of it is having compassion for people we don't understand that are social outcasts. And I absolutely think that Jesus would have stood with the people who are marginalized today, and trans people are part of that group. So at the very least, can you create space for that, right? That's part of the conversation. A more theologically driven conversation is actually talking about the Bible. You mentioned that you're an English major. I don't know if they call it majors in the UK. Okay.
I read English.
You read English? Okay. And one of the things that I took in college was the history of English language class. And it was, you know, not comprehensive because it was one semester, but one of the primary ways that we studied the history of English was through reviewing different versions of the Bible. And the reason I like to say that is not to dismiss the word of God or the value of that, but to highlight human error, because there has been a lot of different translations of the Bible because it was written 2000 years ago. And throughout that time, yes, I'm again not refuting the word of God, but the word of people is sometimes not exactly the word of God. And as we study, the reason we use the word the Bible to study English is because it has changed. The translations have changed over periods of time versus based on what rulers were the primary people changing the rules. So fascinating history of the Bible. I'm not explaining it in like the most in-depth ways, but there's a book called Unclobber that talks a lot about this. But I think if somebody's open to thinking critically about the Bible, again, not the word of God, but about the writing of the Bible. And I think it's important to distinguish the two. Sometimes that can help open a little bit more about actually being committed to one's faith and not to the ways that some people have abused faith.
Yeah. I'm not really a religious person myself, but I find it a bit weird how sometimes people use like Christianity, the religion of love and acceptance, to kind of spin it into hateful rhetoric. And I think a lot of that comes from misrepresentations and misinterpretation. But kind of moving that on to something quite topical and also quite controversial, in some aspects maybe more controversial than sports, which is legislation around bathrooms. And you wrote in your book how there's been no actual effect on sexual assault statistics across the states when this was kind of implemented. So the kind of the changes to the legislation around bathrooms, and there's been, I feel, quite a lot of panic around this. And I was wondering why you think the panic is kind of so gripping on public discourse, and what do you think about these concerns?
That
are being raised by people. Yeah.
So the shortest answer is that the panic is gripping and effective because it is playing on real fears that I think are valid. So for example, the bathroom one is the rallying cry is we need to protect women and girls, right? And here's the thing. We do need to protect women and girls. I can agree with that. I hope both of you can agree with that, right? I absolutely want to protect women and girls. But the problem is that they're using that rallying cry and then marrying it with a ton of propaganda saying that the thing that threatens women and girls is somehow trans people in bathrooms specifically. And when we do that, we're taking the base fear of wanting to protect women and girls, and then we're marrying it immediately. Like, again, this is just propaganda tactics, immediately with the thing that we want people to be afraid of, which is trans people. And then we get the ban of trans women or trans people, generally speaking, in bathrooms. But we're using a really valid fear and a really important fear. The problem is that the people saying that we need to, you know, ban trans women or ban trans people from bathrooms are often the same people that are likely to perpetuate assault. And so a lot of it is about pointing fingers when the fingers should be pointed back at the people who are pointing the fingers. The most common perpetrators of sexual assault for young people are actually men who are already either related to or friends of the family with the kids that are assaulted, which is bonkers. This is a statistic that was, I believe, in my book, but if it's not, I'll say it now. 53% of girls who are sexually assaulted, sexually abused, are done so by their biological fathers. 53% wow. of girls who are assaulted by their biological fathers. So the people that we're afraid of are the people who are making these laws, right? These are toxic cis men who are basically pointing the fingers to scapegoat trans people when the problem is way, way not trans people and way bigger, honestly, than trans people. I really think we need to think more. This is where the facts need to be really loud. And then the fingers pointed need to really see what we're looking at, because there is a big problem with sexual assault for young people, and specifically girls and specifically women. But the people perpetuating those problems are not trans people. There's actually been zero evidence that there is any issue with any trans people assaulting anybody in bathrooms. And there actually has been also no documented cases of a man pretending to be a woman to gain access to women's spaces to then assault women or play sports, if we want to go down that route. But even if there was a problem of that, who is the problem? The man, not trans women. So I think the reason that it's so effective is because people are very afraid of girls and women being sexually assaulted. Why? Because they are being sexually assaulted, right? But again, the problem is not trans people. And it's just the propaganda and the rhetoric is so powerful and so effective that it's become this, you know, bullhorn that everybody is listening to because they're afraid and they're being told, here's the solution. And people want so badly to have a solution to this rampant issue. But again, it's not happening in public bathrooms. It's not happening at the hands of trans people. It's happening largely at home with trusted men, either ones that are already family members or others that are friends of the family, which is a bigger problem that we need to solve. And we need to stop punishing trans people for the harm that all of these men are really perpetuating.
Mm. It's actually so true how the way the rhetoric works is it's like a Trojan horse. You have sexual assault of young girls and women, and you hide that and you make it about trans people. And I think a similar way that's been done actually, with another thing, which is a completely legitimate issue, is child's mental health, around the discussion, with puberty blockers, et cetera. Yep. And there's actually a report which came out today, literally just this morning. I don't know if you would have seen it. For your time, it would have been in the middle of the night by the NHS. By the NHS, claiming that, they want to reduce the use of blockers in the UK because of mental health, related conditions, et cetera, that it could be dangerous. And I wanted to ask you what you would say to our trans listeners in the UK in response to this, because it's probably going to cause a lot of change in how they're treated medically, which there's already discrimination, and how you would respond to again, like another Trojan horse like that.
Yeah. I briefly saw the report, not at the middle of the night, but when I woke up, there's a lot there. One of the things that I have a big issue with, and this goes back to our conversation about information and disinformation, is that a lot of people are sharing their opinions about healthcare, sports, bathrooms, what have you, who don't have expertise in the space, right? We have lots of people who are legislating on gender affirming care and, for example, puberty blockers, who are not doctors, who have no medical experience, and who are claiming to be some sort of expert by the simple fact that they are a politician. Right. I'm going to talk about the United States in this particular realm because we have so many politicians that are saying, oh, these are not safe. And they are not listening to any medical expertise, right? In the United States, every single major medical, psychological, and psychiatric association has affirmed the use of puberty blockers as well as other gender affirming care for kids, for children, for minors, of course, through many different guidelines, and not just giving it to any kid that asks, but through competent guidelines and care, as with any medical care. But they've affirmed this care, and yet politicians saying, aha, we know better. Right. And I believe that's part of what's happening in the in the UK as well. As far as I read, it was the prime minister that said there should be extreme caution. And I think I don't know enough about that particular story. I'd have to read it, but I want to caution us to think about who we're listening to when we are taking into account opinions about healthcare, especially. Are we listening to actual healthcare professionals? Or are we listening to people who have, you know, power involved, for example, like in the United States with politicians? Beyond that, simply put, puberty blockers have been used on cisgender kids who are not trans for decades. There have been no issues with them. And there should be no reason that we can't use them for trans kids. People will try to cite side effects of them that are not an issue as well. And there's been several studies to debunk that. I could go like full science on this and share this with you, but we only have 4 minutes left. So I'm not going to do that in this moment. But I want to remind us that we've actually have lots of research that puberty blockers are not only safe, but also effective in helping improve the mental health of those who use them.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good way to kind of bring it towards the end of the conversation, because that is one of the more controversial ones. But in any case, obviously we've got limited time. But I think I would recommend people to go and just like read the information, speak to loads of different people, speak to like scientists, and that's if people make informed decisions, that's I think the right way to do it.
Yeah.
I guess just our final question would be something that you speak about, this idea that most people are good people, and I feel like that kind of suggests optimism for the future. So I guess, how optimistic are you, Skylar, and what do you think the next steps are now?
I would say I'm generally an optimistic person. I think it would be fairly difficult to continue doing the work that I do without being optimistic. I mean, this is my fourth interview today in sharing these kinds of thoughts, and I'm optimistic even in doing these interviews, because that means there's four, you know, groups of people and media platforms that are interested in hearing about what I have to say and about trans rights. So I am generally optimistic. If we think about time, like chronologically speaking, in the next couple of years, I'm not so feeling that optimistic. I think I'm very afraid about this upcoming election cycle for lots of different reasons. I think the greater world in general has had a lot of human rights issues. I mean, there's multiple genocides occurring: Palestine, Sudan, Ethiopia, Congo. I mean, we're doing a lot of crappy stuff as a world and as a people. So I'm not feeling particularly optimistic in the short term, but I do feel optimistic more generally, because I can see that, yes, there's all this misinformation that people are digesting, but what's also happening is people are connecting across communities, and they're connecting across the globe. And I think that is really powerful, to see so many people from different backgrounds, and particularly marginalized folks, being able to connect so that they can then be more empowered and then create the change that they want to see.
Great. Well, I can speak for myself in saying that I really enjoyed that conversation. I actually learned a lot. Thank you, Skylar.
Thank you so much for having me, Lucas and Ollie. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for that conversation. This has been The Loaf Podcast with Skylar Baylor, signing off.
Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode with Skylar Baylor. Seems like you did, since you got the whole way through. If you want to check out another video with Eliud Kipchoge, another amazing athlete, click right there. Don't forget to like and subscribe. We've got way more guests coming. And if you've got any more suggestions, put them right down below.